to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now on episode 630. And my name is still Camden Busey. I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois, at the Reform Forum Studios. And I'm delighted to be back to talk about some fun stuff. We've got a conversation lined up today. We're going to be talking about the Hebrew language and discourse analysis, looking at our Bibles. But we're going to do so in a way that certainly is applicable to all listeners and viewers, not just people with training in Hebrew. So I hope that we'll come away from this with a great conversation and a renewed interest and a vigor in studying our Bibles. And to address these things, we have a friend of mine and someone who's no stranger to Reform Forum and Christ the Center. We have Reverend Dr. Matthew Patton. Matthew Patton is a friend of mine. He's a pastor out at Covenant OPC in Vandalia, Ohio, graduate from Wheaton Graduate School, from Westminster Theological Seminary as well. Welcome back, Matthew. It's good to see you.
Yeah, great to be back. Thanks for having me, Camden.
Oh, yeah. It's my pleasure, and always love talking to you, and especially when we can expose some of those conversations to a wider listenership. And we're really excited today because there's an occasion for this conversation. We'd love having you anytime to talk about especially stuff in Old Testament Deuteronomic history. But in the course of your study of things such as the Book of Kings, we have now fruits of that labor, and you're exposing to us many of the tools of your study with this new book in this Basics of Biblical Hebrew series, the Zondervan Language Basics series. This is the Basics of Hebrew Discourse, a guide to working with Hebrew prose and poetry. And it's written by our guest today, Matthew Patton, as well as co-written alongside of Frederick Clark Putnam. So many people know Fred Putnam, know that name as well, edited by Miles Van Pelt. And you know, people can see, Matthew, I don't think you can see this angle, but off to the side here, we have another book in that similar series, The Basics of Biblical Hebrew, the often affectionately called Pratico Van Pelt. You know, like that's the guy's name. It was two last names. And then I also have the Walt K. O'Connor. And everyone knows what that is if you've studied Hebrew. It's the Introduction to Biblical Hebrew Syntax. So we've got this now, which is going to help, and it fills in some gaps. And so I'm excited to talk about this today. But before we get and jump into this, Matthew, I'd always love getting an update about what you're up to and about your ministry and the family. And I know a lot of people who listen know you as well. So I'm curious if you could just give us a little bit of an update as to how things are going in Ohio and maybe some of the things you're working on, because I know you're busy pastor theologian.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. God's definitely been blessing us here at Covenant. We've been seeing a great deal of growth in our congregation, and also my co-pastor, Brad Pepo, has been he's a serial church planter. We call him the spiritual frontiersman of Ohio. And
is that why he's always digging things? He's always doing something in his yard, cutting down trees and digging holes.
Exactly. He's been really doing amazing work in our area. We've seen a number of church plants come together through his labors, and now he's working in downtown Dayton to establish a new church plant there. So we're really praising God for how that's going forward. And then in terms of my own labors, this book was a major milestone to be able to finish this off. And now working for on a new project for the Zondervan Exegetical Commentary series on the Book of Jeremiah. So it's going to be a major project that'll take a number of years to complete. But what that series is trying to do is apply the principles of discourse analysis to each biblical book. And so I'll be doing discourse analysis through the whole book of Jeremiah, and then thinking as a result of that discourse analysis on the larger canonical questions. And really, how is Jeremiah Christian scripture is one of the great questions. Amen. I've been wrestling with for a long time. So,
well, people might not pick up on what you're saying, because obviously everyone's like, well, Jeremiah's in the Bible, it's Christian scripture. That maybe you could explain even that phrase, because that might be a contested statement within broader Old Testament studies.
Yeah, I remember once I was teaching a a class, and it was on the book of Jeremiah, and I was just saying at the very outset, hey, first thing we need to understand is that Jeremiah is Christian scripture. In other words, it's witnessing to Christ's death and resurrection, to the eschatological kingdom that he brought about through his work on the cross. And therefore, if you really want to know what Jeremiah means, read the New Testament.
Yeah.
And I had one of my students at that point like laugh out loud, and they're like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to be disrespectful, but like that's the exact opposite of what I just learned in this other class."
Right.
Where they're basically saying, "No, if you get something, if you conclude that the book of Jeremiah is about something that the original audience in, 6th century BC would not have understood, then you're really just doing eisegesis. You're not doing good grammatical historical exegesis." And so, my response to that would simply be, we're not just after the human author's meaning, but the divine author. And you really can only understand what God means by a given text of scripture until you've seen it in light of the whole.
Right. And the Bible itself, Peter, 1 Peter chapter 1,
exactly,
is very clear to say that even the prophets didn't understand everything that they were prophesying. They were searching and inquiring in the scriptures as to the meaning of the words they were saying under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, speaking things into which even angels long to look, And so that's the great mystery. And so that's one thing among many that I really appreciate about you, Matthew, that there's a great depth and a great breadth in your knowledge and understanding of the scriptures and the system of doctrine. But you always bring it back to what this means, just in very basic terms, basic categories, very catechetical heart in a sense. Perhaps that's because of your army at home and your many children and your many, your many years of practice of raising up little ones in the faith, that you're able to bridge that gap. And so I hope I know you're able to do that today as we talk about this book. And so I want to encourage people that haven't tuned out yet that they need to listen. Even if you don't know Hebrew, this doesn't need to be a real technical conversation when we're speaking about Hebrew discourse. And many of the lessons, perhaps most, if not all, that Matthew's going to explain have application for those of us who study even in English, which is, of course, a translation of the original. And so, Matthew, why don't we start first off just by me asking you giving you the opportunity to speak about this project. And how did this project come about so that you were involved in writing this book, but where does it fit in the economy of other Hebrew resources from Zondervan? Because people might have a couple of those or wonder, what level is this targeted for? Who should buy this? And how does it complement the other books that are already available?
Yeah, thank you. The occasion for starting to work on this book was about 8 years ago when my cousin's husband was teaching a class and invited me to come and just do a seminar on Hebrew discourse analysis. And I realized as I was putting that together that there's incredible resources out there for understanding how does a Hebrew text flow, how does it create logical connections from clause to clause so you can understand a coherent message. There's incredible resources out there under the heading of Hebrew discourse analysis, but it's all highly technical. And you have to wade into all these, difficult conversations about linguistics and other things. There's a lot of jargon. And I realized there was a real need for a text that would be for like a third semester Hebrew student who's learned the basics of Hebrew. They can do some basic parsing of verbs and can make their way through a sentence. But they're now at the stage where they need to start thinking about, okay, now I'm able to kind of piece together what a sentence means, but how does it really flow together as a whole text? How do I begin really reading the Bible in such a way that I can start preaching the message of a whole unit of text, like a paragraph or an entire passage? And as I was looking around, there just really isn't anything for third semester Hebrew students that distills all these insights of discourse analysis for someone in a non-jargon, non-technical kind of way. So that was kind of the impetus for starting this book. And then it was a long road to actually see it come to fruition, really thanking the Lord for just the wonderful help I've had from Miles Van Pelt and Fred Putnam and all the wonderful folks at Zondervan making this a reality. So that's really the itch I'm trying to scratch is taking people from being readers of sentences to now being readers of paragraphs and readers of texts. That's the kind of the gem insight of discourse analysis. We understand about how sentence syntax works, where you've got a subject and a main verb and a direct object maybe, and then maybe some other things like adverbs that modify the main verb. But that sentence syntax, now we're taking one step higher and we're asking, okay, tell me now about paragraph syntax. How does each clause in the paragraph relate to the other clauses? And what are the cues that each language has for showing those relationships between clauses?
Yeah, and that's really where, now I always joke, you know, the verbs are where the action is. But when we start relating sentences together, then we can start building a case for something. And as we're studying the Hebrew language and studying biblical texts, it's very important not only to know what each sentence means discreetly, but what function they're serving within a narrative or an argument or a poem. They're connected. And this is overly simplistic, but everyone knows if you just take a document and just randomly mix up the sentences, you don't have the same document anymore. Okay.
That's right.
So why is that? And then how can we study the ordering of the sentences, the paragraphs, all the textual forms and units, and therefore understand the mind of the author. And by that, not only the secondary author, the human author, but the primary author as God has revealed himself to us. So, why don't I ask you this then, you know, to provide a little bit more formal definition of discourse analysis. That's kind of a definition and function, but how would you define it? And really, how would you distinguish your approach in this book from some other, you know, sociocultural approaches that we might find from other scholars and in other forms of study, you know, not just biblical studies, but discourse analysis in general?
Yeah. I think with any approach or method, what you start to realize is that a method is all about which questions you're asking. And so the discourse analysis question is, how does this unit of text that I'm looking at right here, this clause or even this whole paragraph, how does it relate to what went before? So you can ask that at a clause-to-clause level. And say, you know, and really, if you think about it, we're all doing discourse analysis informally all the time. Anytime you're listening to anybody,
your brain is doing
any book, you're doing discourse analysis without really knowing that's what you're doing, because you're reflecting on what the person is saying and how one thing relates to the next. You know, so if I'm saying, you know, because of this and because of that, therefore this, you know that those first two things I said are the basis for the conclusion that I ended with. And that conclusion is marked with the word therefore. And so you've done discourse analysis to understand how those things relate together. So really all discourse analysis is doing is saying, how does the language of this text show me what the relationship is between the line I'm looking at and all the lines that went before it, and also the ones that are going to come after as well. So you're from that, you know, the result of that work of patiently asking that question of every single clause will be an overarching sense of the message of the text. I remember once one of my friends did discourse analysis on the book of Romans, Paul's letter to the Romans, and he did it, you know, just line by line by line. But then he continued to move outwards to, okay, now that I understand how the lines of this paragraph relate to each other, and I kind of get the main point of the paragraph. Now, how does this paragraph relate to the next paragraph? And then he kept on going out until he had, you know, basically Romans 1 through 11 as one huge unit, Romans 12 through 16 as second huge unit, all connected with that important verse, Romans 12, 1, therefore, brothers, in light of the mercies of God, you know, and right. He moves to the indicative, I mean, the imperative, rather, I urge mm-hmm. you to offer your bodies as living sacrifice. Like that, in saying that, realizing, okay, the indicative of Romans 1 through 11 grounds the imperative of Romans 12 through 16, you've now done discourse analysis all the way to the highest level you can do.
Unless, I guess, you do it canonically. And some people have attempted that, too.
Yeah. Yeah, in some cases you have to, because like Leviticus 1:1 begins with a continuative form, a viatical form, which implies that we have a continuation of the narrative that ended at the end of Exodus. So yeah, there's definitely discourse analysis within, you know, between books even. So
sure. Yeah. So for those, I mean, I imagine many people have already connecting the dots on this, but you know, spell it out for us then, you know, why is this important? What would happen if we were to study our Bibles then without doing discourse analysis, even though it's really impossible to do because our brains just work this way in terms of being rational creatures made in the image of God, especially when we're in speaking and conversing in our mother tongue, or as Wycliffe would like to say, our heart language, you know, you can't not do it, you know, but if we were just to translate our Bibles and then, you know, if pastors were to preach without doing proper discourse analysis, what are really the consequences? Where can we go wrong?
Yeah, great question. You know, I had a colleague back at Wheaton when I was teaching there who said he was one of the Greek profs there. And he said, you know, every time I hear a pastor open his mouth and say, well, in the Greek, he says, every time I hear that, I prepare to hear an exegetical fallacy. Which is a really sad kind of thing. It's sort of like, man, why do we teach original language if that's the result? And I think that is the danger, though, is if you don't really attend to the larger unit of text, if you don't really ask yourself the discourse analysis question, how does this clause relate to this clause, and track the flow of thought, then I think the danger is you're going to get the kind of golden nugget approach. So I was thinking ahead of time about what might be a good example of this. And one that came to mind is actually from Acts 2. I realize we're talking about Hebrew discourse analysis, but it works for Greek too here.
Yeah, but they're Hebrews speaking Greek, so I think it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, Peter, he's saying here, you know, there's just a couple of verses from Acts 2, 32 and 33. This Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses, being therefore exalted at the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured out this that you yourselves are seeing and hearing. Obviously, the context being Pentecost and the outpouring of the Spirit. And I think, you know, if you're just reading this in the original language and you've got the kind of golden nugget approach, you might be drawn to the end of verse 32, where he talks about how of this, the resurrection, we're all witnesses. And the word there in Greek is martus, which is connected to our word martyr. And you might be tempted to say, well, you know, hey, you know, the main point of this passage is we're all witnesses who will be martyrs, and kind of using a knowledge of the original language, but kind of going in a different direction from what the message of that text is.
Right.
Whereas if you actually do discourse analysis on this passage, you realize there's two big ideas in these two verses. First one being God raised up Jesus, verse 32. And really the discussion about them being witnesses, that's a subsidiary point to the resurrection there. He's just saying, now I'm expanding on that idea of the resurrection. We're witnesses of that. But the main idea in verse 32 is the resurrection.
Right.
And then the second main idea, verse 33, is that now the result of that resurrection is he's poured out this, namely the Spirit, that you yourselves are seeing and hearing. So as you attend to what are the main ideas of each verse and how does each clause relate to the others, what ends up happening for you is that the main message of the text kind of falls into your lap, and in a sense, your sermon oftentimes falls in your lap. So if I were preaching this text, I'd be talking about, you know, first the fact of the resurrection, verse 32, Jesus is raised by God, and then the result of the resurrection, verse 33, with the Spirit being poured out. And when I do that, and this is my burden, when you do that, then the message of your preaching is in fact the message of the text itself. What is the logical relationships within the text? And how can I then bring those logical relationships to my listeners, to the audience? So they're really hearing not just sort of a little, oh, look at this little insight from the original language, but they're really letting the original language show you the flow of thought of the passage, so that that logical flow of thought is then your message, whether you're mm-hmm. preaching or teaching or leading a Bible study or just, you know, encouraging a friend. So this is why I think it's so important to attend to discourse analysis.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It just reminds me of a friend of mine. He's an unbeliever, but I just had coffee with him this morning, but I meet him over at the local diner a few times a week. He goes, how do you preach like two sermons a week? Don't you ever just run out of ideas? And it's an honest question. I was like, well, my job isn't to come up with new ideas. It's to be a messenger or a herald and say what's there. Oh, really?
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So discourse analysis is a tool that helps us be better heralds. But that's not just for preachers. That's for personal study, but also all those who are leading their families and trying to teach them about the Bible, and people that are leading Bible studies and whatever. So this is for all Christians, really, discourse analysis. And without it, we're not ultimately going to understand fully what the Lord is doing. His inspiration of the text is not just at the word level. It's neither just at the clause level or the sentence level or the paragraph level, but it's plenary. It's the full writings, all of it, from the wide-angle view all the way down to the macroscopic, microscopic level. And we need to study the text at all levels, and it's important to do that. So, Matthew, how then, you know, what would be a sociocultural approach to the text then, as we just compare discourse analysis in different approaches? You have a text-oriented view, but there are other people that haven't done that.
Yeah, so in broader linguistics, there are others who, when they're talking about discourse analysis, are actually attending not so much to, you know, that what I'm talking about, how the details of the language highlight the relationships between texts, but they're more interested in how texts have an effect societally. And so in this other definition of discourse analysis, we're attending to things like how, you know, it's really becoming more of a hermeneutical issue of how does my, you know, understanding of genre, cultural expectations about how different, you know, how different linguistic phenomena will affect me socially, that is going to be a different, just a completely different set of questions from what I'm asking, which is how does the language show me the relationship between texts?
Yeah. And so on that point, then, if we're looking at the language and trying to understand the relationship among texts and trying, therefore, to understand better the logical flow and the message of those texts, how does discourse analysis relate to other studies, other investigations of those texts? And you have a section in your books. I should say this is largely, you've written roughly the first half of this book in tandem with Dr. Putnam. But you describe how discourse analysis can provide a foundation for further study. How so?
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, excuse me. When I'm getting ready to preach each week, what am I doing, you know, in preparation? Well, I'm starting with just going through the passage, just translating it, making sure I understand the meaning of individual words. And then I'm doing the discourse analysis step of asking, okay, how does each clause relate one to another? And then from that, deriving the larger structure of that passage. So, okay, there's a big set of indicative statements ending with this imperative conclusion, right? And that's the payoff then of discourse analysis. And then begins all of the other kind of broader exegetical tasks of asking, you know, the synthetic question, okay, how does it fit into the larger book? How does it relate to the canon as a whole and point forward to Christ or connect to Christ and his work? How does therefore it connect to me as a Christian who's united to Jesus? And then, you know, what are practical implications of that? So discourse analysis is kind of one of the preliminary steps of the larger exegetical task. And it's a critical one. And, you know, it's interesting. I think if you're reading through some commentaries, you can tell the guys who are doing discourse analysis. Because if you're not doing discourse analysis, what's going to tend to happen is, you know, each little verse will be kind of treated unto itself, and there'll be these little, you know, gems here and there. But not a sense of the overarching integration of the passage as a whole. And that's really what I'm trying to encourage people to think about is we've got to see how these things all relate together if we're really going to understand what the passage is saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And so on that point, then how does it help in resolving some exegetical debates? Can discourse analysis fit in to help, you know, us to resolve, you know, what some of these passages are actually saying?
Yeah, great question. And here's where, you know, we need to start talking a little bit about the Hebrew language, because when we come to Hebrew, they will have, the Hebrew language has different ways of highlighting connections between clauses and between paragraphs than we have in English. So in English, we rely pretty heavily on what I call discourse markers. They're little particles, usually conjunctions, that help us to see this is how this clause relates to this. So if I say therefore, you know I'm bringing something to a conclusion. Or if I say and then, you know it's going to be the next event probably in some narrative. Or if I say and so, you know, oh, this is the result of what happened before. So Hebrew has those discourse markers, but then it also has things in practices and conventions that we don't have in English and that are foreign to us. And so, you know, one of the things that they do is when they're trying to tell a narrative, they'll have this standard form, which is sometimes called a vital or preterite. Sometimes you hear it referred to as imperfect with the vav consecutive. It's all referring to the same thing. And it'll have this chain of those forms, one after another after another. If you were to hear a little kid in English telling a story and saying, and then, and then, and then, and then, it would sound kind of like weird to us in English.
Yeah, but there's a rhythm.
That would actually be
there's a cadence. It's kind of like a rhythmic.
Yeah. Yeah, and so anytime then that we have a departure from that sequence, that form, that's like, you know, wow, pay attention to me. I'm doing something different now. So, you know, when Jonah is in the storm and it talks about how the Lord hurls the wind and the ship is about to break apart, then all of a sudden the narrator breaks and he says, now, Jonah had gone down into the hold of the ship and fallen asleep. And we realize, okay, that's probably not something he did during the storm. It's probably something that had happened prior to the storm. And what's he doing there? Well, he's giving us a little background flashback there. And that flashback is highlighted by a change in the Hebrew construction. So part of what I'm trying to help people do is pay attention to those transitions. And that then answers your question of how does this help resolve exegetical debates? When we understand those conventions, we can say, okay, we have grounds in this text for seeing that little sequence there of Jonah going and falling asleep as a background comment because of the change in the verbal construction. You went from, you know, the vaictol preterite form to now vav plus a noun plus a katal or perfect form there to describe the little flashback.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding how these conventions work are then the key to being able to, distinguish, one interpretation from another, and weigh those interpretations. Yeah.
So we've mentioned you provided several examples of different narrative markers and mm-hmm. Basic relationships and even non-narrative relationships where we have, reasons, answers,
yeah.
purpose, comparison, condition, concession, just so people understand where we're going with this, as and like, if, then, even though, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. So
right.
those are there. And you've mentioned discourse markers and different conjunctions or particles. Sometimes Hebrew people might not know have these little words that don't actually, it's not that they don't mean anything, but they're not translatable. It's not not right. so much a vocabulary word as it's a marker, like there's a direct mm-hmm. object mm-hmm. marker. It
right.
looks like a
good
word,
example.
But yeah. it doesn't, we'd never translate that because we know our direct markers, our direct objects in English, largely by sentence order.
Correct.
Bob hit the ball.
That's right.
Is different than the ball hit Bob.
Right, right.
In other languages, those might inflect differently. So the ordering doesn't matter, but the form would be different. So that's mm-hmm. just to give people a clue. Let's talk a little bit more technically about verbal sequences and narrative. And still there's application
yeah.
here for English, but what are you addressing here when we're speaking about Hebrew discourse analysis and then these verbal sequences?
Yeah, so what I'm trying to do here is just get people to think about how does even just the verbs being in a certain order sometimes achieve meaning that we wouldn't expect in English. So, one of the key examples that I give this is just not something we're used to, but it's something that happens all the time. Is when you have an imperative in Hebrew that then's followed by a yiktol or imperative, sometimes called, sometimes they appear as cohortative forms. That might on the surface just be translated something like this. This is from Judges 1:3. Judah saying to his brother Simeon, come up with me into my allotment. And then we might be tempted to translate, and we will fight against the Canaanites. Come up with me into my allotment and we will fight against the Canaanites. But really, this pattern, when we have an imperative followed by a vav and then another imperfect form or another imperative form, often achieves the so that or purpose relationship. So even though there's just a vav, a simple conjunction, and then this verbal form, and there's no like discourse marker, there's nothing like the words so that in English, nevertheless, that pattern of verbs achieves a purpose or relationship that we would gloss with the words so that. So, the translation I think we should opt for Judges 1:3 would be something like, come up with me into my allotment so that we might fight against the Canaanites. What's
right.
the purpose of coming up? It's this, that you and I will fight against the Canaanites. So one of the things I try to do in the book is just catalog some of the most common verbal sequences like this that achieve a meaning, a connection between clauses simply by the pattern of it being this clause followed by this kind of clause. So
there's meaning.
Awaken us to those things. Yeah.
There's meaning in various forms here, in places we might mm-hmm. not. It's not merely enough to translate each individual word and to get, the tense, the aspect, and the mood correct.
Right.
But the patterns in the larger structure also give us clues, and they also contain meaning and convey meaning. What other ways are these verbal sequences sometimes used? Are there other purposes for these kinds of patterns?
Yeah, I mean the most common kind of verbal sequence is going to be the continuative idea, which will be different depending on what kind of text you're in. So this is another insight I'm trying to help people to see as they're looking at Hebrew is you have to distinguish what kind of text you're looking at. Are you looking at a narrative where they're telling a story? Or are you looking at, a non-narrative text, like a direct speech kind of situation, Moses giving instructions or something like that?
That's real important genre in Hebrew, right? Because even when you're reading poetry, people might be interested to know this. You know, the imperfect, for example, means something different often in poetry than it does in narrative, which that's not a phenomena we experience so much in English. So right. It's useful to the genre and understanding the form is really important in this particular study.
Yeah. And how are these verbal forms operating will be different depending on what text type you're looking at. One of the things you just mentioned, tense and the challenge of tense in Hebrew. This is another one of my burdens in the book. And I feel like discourse analysis is like the key to a long, difficult problem in the Hebrew language. There's so many books that have been written on the Hebrew verbal system. One of my favorites is Leslie McFall's book, which is entitled The Enigma of the Hebrew Verbal System. It's like, oh boy, this sounds like, it's describing something that I think a lot of Western speakers feel when they're reading Hebrew is, in English, if I want to say something happened in the past, it's really quite simple. I just have a simple past tense verb, he went, and if I want to say it's something that'll happen in the future, I say he will go. Or if it's happening right now, I say he goes. But Hebrew doesn't mark past, present, and future in a simple way where there's a simple tense or form that's going to always, very regularly mean past, present, or future. Instead, the same form, like the perfect form or the katal form, can actually be used very clearly to render both past, present, and future. People look at that and they're like, oh man, like this just sounds totally arbitrary. What I'm trying to do is actually build on some excellent work done by John Cook, who has a great book on time and the Hebrew biblical Hebrew verb. And basically what he argues is that each of these forms does have a default, so that if you look at it all by itself, and there's no context surrounding it, katal or perfect will, default to a past tense thing, he went. But in a larger discourse context, for example, that one I gave from Jonah, there's a katal in there that actually should not be rendered as a simple past, but rather the pluperfect. Why? Because of the discourse context. So, the Lord hurled the wind, the ship is starting to break up. Those are two simple past things. The Lord hurled the wind and the ship began to break up. And then what happens? There's vav plus a noun plus a katal form there. Yeah. And how should we render that? Well, in context, it should be, now Jonah had gone below. And notice, I didn't just say a simple past. I didn't just say he went below. No, I said had gone below, the pluperfect. Why? Because of the larger discourse context. And so part of what I'm trying to do with the book is to help people to see, when you pay attention to the discourse context, it actually, most of the time, makes it very obvious what tense to render a Hebrew verb in. So even though they don't have a simple way of, this form always is past tense, this form is always future tense, they can still very straightforwardly communicate tense. It's just the tense is a product not only of the form of the verb, but of the whole context as well. As one of the authors said, when a Hebrew farmer went out for the, kissed his wife to go out into the field that morning and was telling her what he was going to do that day, it was pretty obvious, like what had already happened, what he was going to do. The the fact that he didn't have a simple future past or present tense didn't hamper him from communicate the idea of tense.
Right. These aren't like timeless people. They understand cause and effect, before and after, and can communicate that rationally. There's no doubt about it. So what you've got, the element number one you described was the discourse markers, and then you have in two parts element number two on verbal sequences. But then element number three comes in, maybe with a word none of us has ever heard before, preposing and verbless clauses. So how do you define that, preposing and then also verbless clauses? Because we might not even know what a verbless clause is or how it's used.
So really what I'm trying to do here is particularly highlight one thing that will happen when, as you're reading Hebrew all the time, which is when a either a noun or a prepositional phrase will precede the main verb in the sentence. Typically, the verb will come first in Hebrew. This is unlike English. Normally in English, we have the subject first and then the verb and then the direct object and so on. In Hebrew, oftentimes the verb comes first and then the subject and the object after that.
And then in German, the verb comes last, sometimes at the end of the page.
Yeah. So each language has its own convention. And anytime that convention is broken, it's important. And that's what I'm saying with preposing. So when you have a noun or something other than a verb at the front slot of the sentence, that's a very significant thing for the text flow. And there's a number of things it can mean. And this actually is just as a little sidebar, one of my other burdens in this book is, as I was reading through the literature on discourse analysis, it struck me how many times people said, you know, this form always means this, or this situation like preposing always means that. And you know, one of the things I found as I actually read through a ton of Hebrew in preparation for this book is, well, okay, oftentimes it means that, you know, like 60% of the time, but then there's all the other situations too. And so I'm trying to help people to say, okay, this is partly a reference work in addition to a overall study. This book is trying to teach a bigger process of discourse analysis, but it's also providing a taxonomy. Okay, when you see preposing, when you see the noun in the front, it can mean the introduction of background material, like what we saw with Jonah, the instance of Jonah, or it could be something like 1 Samuel 1:21, where it talks about the man Elkanah went up, the father of Samuel here, he went up. And then it says in verse 22, Vahana lo alata, and but Hannah, his wife, his second wife, but Hannah did not go up. And Hannah there is preposed. So what's going on there? Well, here it's not so much a background comment, but actually a simple contrast. Elkanah and all his house went up to worship, but Hannah didn't go up. That contrast between those two parties is highlighted for us by preposing. And that's another very common use of preposing. So
it's drawing attention to what's really important.
Yeah. And it's drawing attention to the logical flow of that narrative.
Right.
I'm drawing a contrast here, everybody. And the way I'm doing highlighting that contrast for you is by the very structure of the sentence, namely, but I'm putting the noun first this time to point this up.
Yeah, it's like the our colloquial phrases, though in a much more optimistic and beneficial context. But we have phrases like the squeaky wheel gets the grease. Well, why? Because that's the one that sticks out. Or you know, you don't want to. You know, the nail that's sticking up is the one that gets hammered down. Well, this is sticking things out on purpose so that
right,
it draws
right.
our attention to it to realize, well, this is what the author is instructing us to pay attention to. Yeah.
Yes, exactly right.
So real quick, just perhaps even to try to wrap things up, and I know we don't have a ton of time to go through the everything. That's why people need to read the book. We're not just going to, this isn't an audiobook version, but an introduction to, so that people can go pick the book up. But I think it would be useful at least to provide people a thumbnail sketch of a process for discourse analysis, at least with Hebrew prose. Yeah. What are the steps that you would encourage? And that might reinvigorate many exegetes and people engaging in Bible study just to start acting on these steps in their own personal study.
Yeah, and really what I'm about to sketch is a simple process that you can do with English. You may not have the sensitivity to some of the dynamics we've just been discussing that the original language gives you, and that's why pastors work hard to learn Hebrew, and that's why it's so worthwhile to learn Hebrew, because these logical connections will stand out to you more. But yeah, basically anybody can do this for an English text too. You just take the text and you break it down into clauses. So it could be a complete sentence, you know, and he went, or it could be a dependent clause, you know, while he was going. That would be its own clause that then depends on something that's going to follow. So you break the text into clauses and give, I just make a little table in Word or whatever word processor and give each clause its own box. And then on the right hand side of it, what I do is if I'm looking at the Hebrew text, I'll actually pay attention to all these different signals that Hebrew uses to highlight relationships, things like preposing and verbal sequences and the discourse markers like therefore and such. And you could pay attention to those discourse markers in English too, words like therefore or and then. And then on the right-hand side of the text, just go through and ask for each clause, how does it relate to what went before, and provide a label for it. You know, this is the result of the previous two verses, or this is the circumstance of the clause that's going to follow. And you provide a label for all of it. And then you've done the discourse analysis for the whole text, and you go back and you say, okay, have I really understood properly the flow? You kind of reevaluate it. And at that point, you're prepared to start saying, okay, what's the big flow of thought in this text? Okay, he's stating three reasons and then a conclusion. Or he's giving a five-step process. And those conclusions are then vital for moving forward with exegesis at that point, which is beyond the purview of discourse analysis. Starting to think about, okay, how do I relate this now to the theology of the text as a whole, mm-hmm. and such. Yeah.
Now, are there companion resources as well for this book? I see, and you've indicated to me before, there might be video lectures that are available to help reinforce this, or just to be another means by which we may learn the same lessons.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people who are totally new to this, the video lectures will be a big help. Basically, myself, Miles, and Fred, we distilled the book into 14 lectures that are about 20 minutes each. And this is about to come out from Zondervan. And it's just sort of plain English, kind of stepping you through the big ideas of the book and helping you to grasp the larger ideas at work. So that's a really helpful companion resource as well. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, Matthew, it's always fun to speak with you, but I do want people to pick this book up, The Basics of Basics of Hebrew Discourse, A Guide to Working with Hebrew Prose and Poetry. It is available right now from Zondervan, and we're excited about the fact that this is out there and that people can come to learn their and understand their Bible better. But there are many other resources in this series from Zondervan, and so they'll all be helpful, but the video lectures will be available. And then there's Miles Van Pelt also has Biblical Hebrew, A Compact Guide. And then Van Pelt and Pratico both have Biblical Hebrew Vocabulary in Context, in addition to just the basic textbooks that people can use to study Hebrew. And there are a lot of there's a wealth of resources, and there's a daily dose of Hebrew, which isn't a Zondervan thing, but for people who might want to keep their Hebrew sharp. And they also have lectures and lessons where you can learn some basics. So it's not impossible. Even if you're not going to seminary, never intend to, you could still learn Hebrew at home And there's a wealth of resources now that weren't there even 10 years ago where you can learn and study. Why wouldn't you want to learn how to read the Bible in the original language? It's not weird. Like, maybe it is unusual, but you shouldn't be ashamed of wanting to do that. And if people at church laugh at you, think you're nuts, just say, hey, I want to read the Bible in the way that God delivered it. It doesn't mean our English Bible is wrong or bad, but why wouldn't you want to read it in the original? Yeah, so maybe there's one or two listeners out there that are going to take up a challenge and say, I'm going to learn this. And if you need some help or guidance, call Matthew.
That's right. Anyway. I couldn't agree with you more, brother. I feel like reading the Bible in original language, it's almost like you're getting to read it for the first time. There's just a freshness. It's almost like, you know, seeing a movie in black and white and then seeing it
entirely
in color. The freshness, the vividness of it stands out in a whole new way. New things connect in your mind, and there's really there's no substitute for it. So,
absolutely.
Thank you, brother, for hosting me. And I fully expect the ratings of Crisis Center to go way up when people see that we have a we have a discussion of Hebrew discourse analysis.
Things here do not operate according to the ways of the world. That's for sure. And often the nichier we get, the more response there is. It's counterintuitive, but we'll see. So it's good talking to you, brother. I want to encourage people to head on over and visit Vandalia if you can. If you're traveling through Ohio, you can go visit the church, Covenant Presbyterian Church, which is available online at CPCVandalia, like the onion, .com. Information about their services and location is there. You can find links and other resources to books and such from Dr. Patton. I'll link to in our episode description. And of course, our website, reformedforum.org, has information about all of our programs and upcoming events and other things. So I'm going to be on the road a lot this year, and looking forward to meeting a lot of folks. I believe when this episode comes out, I either might be in Escondido, California or thereabouts, and visiting some folks out in Orange County as well. And I've got a lot of other trips coming up. I'm going to be heading down to South Carolina, to Greenville, in March. And so if you're interested in heading to the conference there, look me up. Maybe we can connect. So a lot going on in 2020, but we're excited. And I want to thank everybody for listening. And we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.